regulatory restrictions on the use of drones by a government agency for location or mission?
At this point, we haven't seen any statutory restrictions on drone use. I think that there are a few different bills that have been proposed in Congress, but there haven't been any limitations placed on Customs and Border Protection's use of drones. And in fact, in the most recent immigration bill, or the most recent version of the immigration bill, Customs and Border Protection has been mandated to increase its drone surveillance to 24 hours a day, 7 days a week along the borders. And that would extend within about 100 miles into the United States.
What type of surveillance are they capable of doing with these drones? Is it simply photographic, or do they have other capabilities?
Well, they have thermal imaging capabilities, so they're able to do a lot of nighttime surveillance. Infrared cameras are also on the drones. And different types of radar technologies, advanced radar technologies, so they can do a kind of detection analysis where they can see if a landscape has been changed. We also saw in some records that were released to EPIC, another privacy and civil liberties organization, that Customs and Border Protection has considered equipping the drones with communications intercept technology.
There are also indications that they're considering equipping some of these drones at least with non-lethal weapons, the so-called non-lethal weapons. I'm trying to imagine what they are, launching spider webs from the sky or something.
That's true. That was part of the report that we received from Customs and Border Protection. It was very concerning. This is the first we've seen of any agency at the federal, state, or local level that has considered equipping its drones with weapons, any type of weapons. Now, of course, the military uses weapons on drones flown overseas, and the Predator drone, which is what Customs and Border Protection is flying, has been designed to carry weapons for the military, but this is the first we've seen or heard of any agency that has talked about using weapons domestically. And I think it's very concerning. This is just one line in the report, and Customs and Border Protection says that at some point in the future, it might consider equipping the drones with non-lethal weapons that would immobilize targets of interest. There's no other information about what types of weapons they might be considering, but I think that that's very worrisome.
In the meantime, they are collecting at least visual and perhaps telephonic or electronic information. Are there any minimization procedures in place, any privacy protections that would control what is done with any information or surveillance that they capture?
We haven't seen any evidence of minimization procedures or any evidence of policies about data destruction. All we've seen is that Customs and Border Protection is interested in recording as much information as it can and sharing that information as widely as it can with other agencies at the state, federal, and even international level.
Are there any moves in the works to try to limit the amount of exposure to unwarranted surveillance of American citizens by drones or other intrusions into privacy like this?
Well, there has been some movement in legislatures at the state, local, and federal level. However, most of the proposed laws we've seen have had exceptions for border control purposes, and Customs and Border Protection would fit into that exception.
So would this perhaps explain why the FBI and local and state law enforcement are going to Customs and Border Protection to conduct surveillance rather than doing it on their own?
Yeah, I think it would help to explain that. Also, it's been, from what we've heard from other agencies, it's relatively challenging to get an authorization to fly a drone from the FAA. So if a state or local law enforcement agency could just go to Customs and Border Protection instead, then they would get around the hurdle of trying to work with the FAA. And also, they might not have their efforts to use a drone recorded anywhere. Before this, we didn't know that these various state agencies were using drones for surveillance because all of the records were held with Customs and Border Protection rather than the local agency.
So in order to keep track of what surveillance is being done on whom, we may have to keep going back to FOIA requests?
I think we do. It's frustrating. I'm really hoping that someday in the near future, the FAA and other agencies that are responsible for drone flights will make their records available online to the public.
Jennifer Lynch is a staff attorney with the Electronic Frontier Foundation. And that's some of the news for Wednesday, July 3rd, 2013. The news was produced in New York with Jose Santiago, Rebecca Miles, and Linda Perry. I'm Andrea Sears in New York for the WBAI, listener-supported news.
The bell for freedom still rings. The bell for freedom still rings. Sorrow to me, but does it ring to know the bell of freedom still rings? The hammer for justice still pounds. The hammer for justice still pounds. We can't have the biggest heart if millions of babies still starve. And the innocent ones still die. The innocent ones still die. We can't value life too high if the innocent ones still die. And see when will we find what we've been missing, that the man in the moon must have found, 'cause he looks upon us with a frown. Out of truth we won't let shine. Light of truth we won't let shine. Tell me, has the world gone blind? The light of truth we won't let shine. As long as there's life, there's still a day. As long as there's life, there's still a day. And I know that we can find our way. For as long as there's life, there's still a day.
Here, let me show you. Yeah, Constitution of the United States. Now, we had to memorize the preamble of that. I still remember it.
You do?
Yeah. Yeah, I'll show you. Hold the book on me.
Okay. All right, go ahead.
Constitution of the United States. Well, just give me the first word and then I'll know the rest.
Okay, we.
We. We?
We.
Are you sure?
I'm looking right at it.
Oh, we. We!
The.
The. We the. We the.
People.
People. We the people. We the people. We the people. We the people.
The United.
We the people of the United flag. Breathe. Wind. Wait. Star.
States.
States. We the people of the United States.
In order.
In order.
To form a.
To form a.
More perfect.
Perfect.
You.
To form a more perfect you.
Union.
Union. In order to form a more perfect union.
S. Ta.
Ta.
Ble.
Ble.
Shh. Shh.
Establish. Establish.
Just.
Establish just,
Test.
Test. Justice. Establish justice.
Ensure domestic tranquility. Provide for the common defense. Promote the general welfare. And secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity to ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. You want to run through that again, or do you think you got it?
I got it.
Good.
If you learn something, you learn it.
And the rock
76, the sky was red, thunder rumbling overhead. Bad King George couldn't sleep in his bed, and on that stormy morn, old Uncle Sam was born. Old Sam put on a three-cornered hat, and in a Richmond church he sat, and Patrick Henry told him that, while America drew breath, it was liberty or death.
What kind of hat is a three-cornered hat?
Nobody who was anybody believed it. Everybody who was anybody, they doubted it. Nobody had faith. Nobody, nobody but Washington, Tom Paine, Benjamin Franklin, Chaim Solomon, Crispus Attucks, Lafayette. Nobody.
Nobody's running a tea party at Boston.
Betsy Ross organized a sewing circle.
Yeah, Paul Revere had a horse race.
And a little ragged group believed it. And some gentlemen and ladies believed it. And some wise men and some fools. And I believed it too. And you know who I am.
Oh, who are you, mister?
Yeah, how come all this?
Well, I'll tell you. Now let me...
No, let us tell you!
Then Mr. Thomas Jefferson, a mighty fine man, he wrote it down in a mighty fine plan. The rest all sided with a mighty fine man, and they crossed their feet and nodded their eyes.
And a mighty fine idea.
Adopted unanimously in Congress, July 4th, 1776.
We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights.
Among these rights are life.
Yes, sir.
Liberty.
That's right.
And the pursuit of happiness.
Is that what they say?
The very words.
That sure does sound mighty fine.
Building a nation is awful tough. The people found are going rough. The 13 states weren't large enough, so they started to expand.
Still nobody who was anybody believed it. Everybody who was anybody, they stayed at home. But Lewis and Clark and the pioneers, driven by hunger, haunted by fears, the Klondike miners and the 49ers, some wanted freedom and some wanted riches, some liked to loaf while others dug ditches. And I believe it too, and you know who I am.
No, who are you, mister, anyway?
Well, I started to tell you.
Yes, mister, tell us who you are.
You see, I represent the whole of... That's it.
Let my people go.
That's the idea.
Old Abe Lincoln was thin and long. His heart was high and his faith was strong. But he hated oppression, he hated wrong. And he went down to his grave to free the slave.
November 19th, 1863, at Gettysburg, Pennsylvania.
And he was right. I believe that, too.
Gee, mister, we still don't know who you are.
Well, I've been trying to tell you. You see, there it is. Who's nobody? I'm the nobody who's everybody.
What's your racket? What do you do for a living?
Well, I'm an engineer, musician, street cleaner, carpenter, teacher.
How about a farmer?
Also,
office clerk?
Yes, ma'am.
Mechanic?
That's right.
Housewife?
Certainly.
Cocky wife?
You said it.
Stenographer?
Uh huh.
Beauty specialist?
Absolutely.
Bartender?
Positive.
Truck driver?
Definitely.
I have seen
all of them. I am the et cetera and the and so forth that do the work.
Now hold on here. What are you trying to give us?
Are you an American?
Am I an American? I'm just an Irish, Negro, Jewish, Italian, French, and English, Spanish, Russian, Chinese, Polish, Scots, Hungarian, Litvak, Swedish, Finnish, Canadian, Greek, and Turk, and Czech, and double Czech American. And that ain't all. I was baptized Baptist, Methodist, Congregationalist, Lutheran, Atheist, Roman, Catholic, Orthodox, Jewish, Presbyterian, Seventh-day Adventist, Mormon, Quaker, Christian, Scientist, and lots more.
Strong, our country's young, and the greatest songs are still unsung. From the plains and mountains we have sprung to keep the faith with those who went before.
We know what it is.
Cheating, out of the shouting, out of the murders and lynching, out of the windbags, the patriotic spouting, out of uncertainty and doubting, out of the carpet bag and the brass platoon, it will come again. Our marching song will come again. Deep as our valleys, high as our mountains, strong as the people who made it, for I have always believed it, and I believe it now.
course of human events, it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another, and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitle them.
A decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation.
We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
That to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. That whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it and to institute new government.
Laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness.
Prudence indeed will dictate that governments long established should not be changed for light and transient causes.
And accordingly, all experience hath shown that mankind are more disposed to suffer while evils are sufferable than to right themselves by abolishing the forms to which they are accustomed.
But when a long train of abuses and usurpations, pursuing invariably the same object, evinces a design to reduce them under absolute despotism, it is their right, it is their duty to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future security.
Such has been the patient sufferance of these colonies, and such is now the necessity which constrains them to alter their former systems of government.
The history of the present King of Great Britain is a history of repeated injuries and usurpations, all having in direct object the establishment of an absolute tyranny over these states.
To prove this, let facts be submitted to a candid world.
He has refused his assent to laws the most wholesome and necessary for the public good.
He has forbidden his governors to pass laws of immediate and pressing importance unless suspended in their operation till his assent should be obtained. And when so suspended, he has utterly neglected to attend to them.
He has refused to pass other laws for the accommodation of large districts of people unless those people would relinquish the right of representation in the legislature, a right inestimable to them and formidable only to tyrants.
He has called together legislative bodies at places unusual, uncomfortable, and distant from the depository of their public records for the sole purpose of fatiguing them into compliance with his measures.
He has dissolved representative houses repeatedly for opposing with manly firmness his invasions on the rights of the people.
He has refused for a long time after such dissolutions to cause others to be elected, whereby the legislative powers, incapable of annihilation, have returned to the people at large for their exercise, the state remaining in the meantime exposed to all the dangers of invasion from without and convulsions within.
He has endeavored to prevent the population of these states, for that purpose obstructing the laws for naturalization of foreigners, refusing to pass others to encourage their migrations hither, and raising the conditions of new appropriations of lands.
He has obstructed the administration of justice by refusing his assent to laws for establishing judiciary powers.
He has made judges dependent on his will alone for the tenure of their offices and the amount and payment of their salaries.
He has erected a multitude of new offices and sent hither swarms of officers to harass our people and eat out their substance.
He has kept among us in times of peace standing armies without the consent of our legislatures.
He has affected to render the military independent of and superior to the civil power. He has combined with others to subject us to a jurisdiction foreign to our Constitution and unacknowledged by our laws, giving his assent to their acts of pretended legislation.
For quartering large bodies of armed troops among us.
For protecting them by a mock trial from punishment for any murders which they should commit on the inhabitants of these states.
For cutting off our trade with all parts of the world. For imposing taxes on us without our consent.
For depriving us in many cases of the benefits of trial by jury. For transporting us beyond seas. to be tried for pretended offenses.
For abolishing the free system of English laws in a neighboring province, establishing therein an arbitrary government, and enlarging its boundaries so as to render it at once an example and fit instrument for introducing the same absolute rule into these colonies.
For taking away our charters, abolishing our most valuable laws, and altering fundamentally the forms of our governments.
For suspending our own legislatures and declaring themselves invested with power to legislate for us in all cases whatsoever.
He has abdicated government here by declaring us out of his protection and waging war against us.
He has plundered our seas, ravaged our coasts, burnt our towns, and destroyed the lives of our people.
He is, at this time, transporting large armies of foreign mercenaries to complete the works of death, desolation, and tyranny, already begun with circumstances of cruelty and perfidy, scarcely paralleled in the most barbarous ages, and totally unworthy of the head of a civilized nation.
He has constrained our fellow citizens, taken captive on the high seas, to bear arms against their country, to become the executioners of their friends and brethren, or to fall themselves by their hands.
He has excited domestic insurrections amongst us, and has endeavored to bring on the inhabitants of our frontiers, the merciless Indian savages, whose known rule of warfare is an undistinguished destruction of all ages, sexes, and conditions.
In every stage of these oppressions, we have petitioned for redress in the most humble terms. Our repeated petitions have been answered only by repeated injury. A prince whose character is thus marked by every act which may define a tyrant is unfit to be the ruler of a free people.
Nor have we been wanting in attentions to our British brethren. We have warned them from time to time of attempts by their legislature to extend an unwarrantable jurisdiction over us.
We have reminded them of the circumstances of our immigration and settlement here.
We have appealed to their native justice and magnanimity.
And we have conjured them by the ties of our common kindred to disavow these usurpations which would inevitably interrupt our connections and correspondence.
They, too, have been deaf to the voice of justice and of consanguinity. We must, therefore, acquiesce in the necessity which denounces our separation and hold them, as we hold the rest of mankind, enemies in war, in peace, friends.
We, therefore, the representatives of the United States of America, in General Congress assembled,
appealing to the Supreme Judge of the world for the rectitude of our intentions, do in the name and by authority of the good people of these colonies solemnly publish and declare
that these United Colonies are and of right ought to be free and independent states.
That they are absolved from all allegiance to the British Crown.
And that all political connection between them and the state of Great Britain is and ought to be totally dissolved.
And that as free and independent states, they have full power to levy war, conclude peace, contract alliances, establish commerce.
And to do all other acts and things which independent states may of right do.
And for the support of this declaration, with a firm reliance on the protection of divine providence,
we mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor.
The following passage, regarding colonial slavery, was originally part of the Declaration of Independence, written by slave owner Thomas Jefferson. However, it was deleted from the final version adopted by the Continental Congress on July 4, 1776. King George III has waged cruel war against human nature itself, violating its most sacred rights of life and liberty, in the persons of a distant people who never offended him, captivating and carrying them into slavery in another hemisphere, or to incur miserable death in their transportation thither. This piratical warfare, the opprobrium of infidel powers, is the warfare of the Christian King of Great Britain. determined to keep open a market where men should be bought and sold. He has prostituted his negative for suppressing every legislative attempt to prohibit or restrain this execrable commerce. And that this assemblage of horrors might want no fact of distinguished dye. He is now exciting those very people to rise in arms among us, and to purchase that liberty of which he has deprived them, by murdering the people on whom he has obtruded them, thus paying off former crimes committed against the liberties of one people, with crimes which he urges them to commit against the lives of another.
Pie, baseball games and picnics in July.
That's America.
Fireworks and marching bands, a pride that only freedom understands.
That's America.
That's America. That's America to me. Arms and willing hands, giving just to help her fellow man.
That's America.
Standing in defense of right, not afraid to give her all to fight.
That's America.
That's America. That's America to me. Him throughout our history.
That's America. That's America.
Families that stand and say, we will serve the Lord today. That's America. That's America. That's America. That's America to me. That's America.
Those who supported independence argued that without a formal declaration of independence, no nation would be willing to aid the colonies. The colonies were basically independent already. The matter needs to be discussed, needs to be pushed forward. Lack of agreement and the importance of the decision led Congress to postpone the decision until the first week of July so that individual colonies could decide on a course of action. And in the meantime, so no time would be lost, they appointed a committee to compose a written statement formally declaring colonial independence. And the committee included John Adams, Thomas Jefferson, Benjamin Franklin, greatest hits, Roger Sherman of Connecticut, and Robert R. Livingston, one of the many Livingstons of New York. And ultimately, the committee appointed Jefferson to draft the document, and he worked during the last 2 weeks of June in 1776. In later years, when Adams and Jefferson were retired presidential types, lots of people wrote to them asking, you know, so tell us what really happened with the Declaration of Independence. What was it like? Why did you do X? Did you really do X? What was he like? You know, sort of all the things that you would want to ask if you could ask these people. Like, what really happened? And both men offered accounts of the writing of the Declaration, and their accounts do not necessarily agree. And they're also pretty in character for each one of these men, particularly John Adams' account of what happened with the decision about who was going to write the Declaration of Independence. And actually, in 1822, Adams wrote a pretty lengthy explanation of how Jefferson was chosen to write the Declaration. I just want to offer you a little piece of it, because it's actually a pretty amazing little recreation. So Adams writes in his letter, You inquire why so young a man as Mr. Jefferson was placed at the head of the committee for preparing a Declaration of Independence. Okay, so there's what the person wrote. So Adams, like, why did you pick that young new guy to write this document? Adams says, I answer, Mr. Jefferson came into Congress in June 1775 and brought with him a reputation for literature, science, and a happy talent of composition. Writings of his were handed about, remarkable for the peculiar felicity of expression. Though a silent member in Congress, he was so prompt, frank, explicit, and decisive upon committees and in conversation, not even Samuel Adams was more so, that he soon seized upon my heart, and upon this occasion, I gave him my vote and did all in my power to procure the votes of others. Okay, so in the end, the committee's voting who should write it, and Adams and Jefferson get the most votes to write the Declaration. So they're made, according to Adams, like a little subcommittee of Adams and Jefferson, and now the subcommittee supposedly is going to draft the Declaration. So Adams continues, the subcommittee met. Jefferson proposed to me to make the draft. I said, I will not. And what I'm going to be reading from here now, it's my favorite part of the story. He wrote a little script, like with what Jefferson says and what he responds. He's no longer even like himself in the letter. He's just recording like he said and then I said and then he said and then I said. So Jefferson says, Adams, you should write it. And Adams says, I will not. You should do it, Jefferson insists. Oh, no, says Adams. Why will you not, asks Jefferson. You ought to do it. This is like, he's like writing a film. He's already imagining, like, the movie of my life. If movies existed, I would be imagining the movie of my life. You ought to do it, says Jefferson. I will not. Why? Reason enough. What can be your reasons? Okay, this is Adams' response. Reason first. You are a Virginian, and a Virginian ought to appear at the head of this business. Reason second. I am obnoxious, suspected, and unpopular. Oh. Poor John Adams. I am obnoxious, suspected, and unpopular. Don't make me write the document. You are very much otherwise. Reason third, you can write 10 times better than I can. Well, Adams has Jefferson respond, if you are decided, I will do it as well as I can. Okay, that's part of a really lengthy, great letter by Adams. Jefferson's account is much less humorous and actually briefer, and he writes in 1823 to James Madison, and he says, no such thing as a subcommittee was proposed. It's like, oops, basic disagreement. But they unanimously pressed on myself alone to undertake the draft. Okay, little disagreement between the two guys, which they never really agreed upon. And he then goes on to discuss in this letter whether the ideas in the Declaration were new or not. And he says, no, no, American mind, blah, blah, blah. Okay, regardless of the precise details as to whether there was or wasn't a subcommittee, Jefferson did draft the Declaration. He submitted it to the others for comment. What were some of Jefferson's sources, right? He's sitting in Philadelphia. He has basically 2 weeks, talk about a paper deadline, to write the Declaration of Independence. What is he going to use? He's pretty pressed for time. So logically, he turned to whatever he could for fodder. And two notable sources were both Virginia documents, logically enough. He drafted a constitution for Virginia, since the colony's in the middle of doing that along with everything else. And that ended up being a source for him of some of the grievances, the long list of grievances in the Declaration. He pulled some of them from that. And then the Virginia Declaration of Rights, which was also part of this constitution-making process, helped contribute to the preamble of the Declaration. Now, of course, Jefferson was careful not just to focus on Virginia words, Virginia charges, Virginia things, because obviously the document is supposed to represent all of the colonies. So, for example, when you read the Declaration, you could see some of the things he's citing happened in Massachusetts, and some of them actually happened in other colonies as well. It needs to be something that is coming from some united expression of the colonial will. One of the passages that ultimately did not end up displaying colonial unity, not surprisingly, concerned slavery. So in Jefferson's draft, he actually has a passage that charges the king that the king, quote, had waged cruel war against human nature itself, violating its most sacred rights of life and liberty in the persons of a distant people who never offended him, captivating and carrying them into slavery in another hemisphere, or to incur miserable death in their transportation thither. Okay, so that's a notable attempt to blame the king for slavery, But the passage ultimately gets stricken out by the Congress, in part for obvious reasons, right? The South is not going to support this. But also, ultimately, Jefferson's declaration, as far as slavery is concerned, had some tortured logic in it, because it first attacks the king for creating slavery, for transporting slaves to America, and then attacks him for offering them freedom if they fight for the British. You inflicted slavery upon us, and you're threatening to free the slaves. Okay, Continental Congress said, okay, not only is the South not really able to grasp this at this particular moment, but this doesn't entirely match up, Jefferson. So in a sense, his ambiguity and ambivalence reflected general ambiguity and ambivalence. But in the end, the total effect of all of these charges was to suggest that the king had sort of de-kinged himself. He had displaced himself, that he and not the colonies had brought events to where they now stood. Now, you know, I think generally we, and also often scholars, tend to really focus on the preamble of the Declaration. But in fact, at the time, it was the specific charges against the king that were considered to be the real meat of the document. The preamble was actually just supposed to be a preamble to the real charges against the king, which were the radical part of the document at the time. And since this document was intended possibly to be a declaration for foreign audiences as well as domestic audiences, it was important that that preamble be a statement, a broad sweeping statement of epic proportions to inspire people to support the cause. The committee's draft ultimately was presented to Congress on June 28th, and then debating and editing began on July 1st. Some of the changes had to do with specific word choices. So, for example, was the king really guilty of, quote, unremitting injuries? Congress preferred repeated injuries. Okay, that was the level of editing taking place of the Declaration. So they thought, well, repeated is a little less extreme than unremitting. That word gets changed. Not all of the changes were intended to tame the document. Sometimes Congress made some of Jefferson's charges more extreme, as when they added to Jefferson's statement about foreign mercenaries words that described it, the act of sending them to the colonies, as, quote, scarcely paralleled in the most barbarous ages. And then, as I mentioned before, they struck the entire passage on slavery. For many Southern delegates, pretty much it was a deal breaker, and as happens so often in this period, the issue of slavery comes up, it can't be dealt with. People don't know how to deal with it, particularly the Southerners, and it keeps getting shunted to the side. And so in a sense, that's what happens here.
July 4th is held up as a day to celebrate the struggle for freedom and independence. But the great abolitionist Frederick Douglass, himself a former slave and the editor of the abolitionist newspaper, the North Star, dared to challenge the exaltation of the holiday. Here is part of his address to the Rochester, New York Ladies Anti-Slavery Society in 1852.
Mr. President, friends and fellow citizens, he who could address this audience without a quailing sensation has stronger nerves than I have. I do not remember ever to have appeared as a speaker before any assembly more shrinkingly, nor with greater distrust of my ability than I do this day. A feeling has crept over me quite unfavorable to the exercise of my limited powers of speech. The papers and placards say that I am to deliver a 4th of July oration. This certainly sounds large and out of the common way for me. It is true that I've often had the privilege to speak in this beautiful hall and to address many who now honor me with their presence, but neither their familiar faces nor the perfect gauge I think I have of Corinthian Hall seems to free me from embarrassment. Fellow citizens, pardon me. Allow me to ask, why am I asked to speak here today? What have I, or those I represent, to do with your national independence? Are the great principles of political freedom and of natural justice embodied in the Declaration of Independence extended to us And am I therefore called upon to bring our humble offering to the national altar and to confess the benefits and express devout gratitude for the blessings resulting from your independence to us? Would to God, both for your sakes and ours, that an affirmative answer could be truthfully returned to these questions. Then would my task be light, and my burden easy and delightful. For who is there so cold that a nation's sympathy could not warm him? Who so obdurate and dead to the claims of gratitude that would not thankfully acknowledge such priceless benefits? But such is not the state of the case. I say it with a sad sense of the disparity between us. I am not included within the pale of this glorious anniversary. Your high independence only reveals the immeasurable distance between us. The blessings in which you this day rejoice are not enjoyed in common. The rich inheritance of justice, liberty, and prosperity bequeathed by your fathers is shared by you, not by me. The sunlight that brought light and healing to you has brought stripes and death to me. This 4th July is yours, not mine. You may rejoice, I must mourn. To drag a man in fetters into the grand illuminated temple of liberty and call upon him to join you in joyous anthems were inhuman mockery and sacrilegious irony. Do you mean, citizens, to mock me by asking me to speak today? What to the American slave is the 4th of July? I answer, a day that reveals to him more than all other days in the year the gross injustice and cruelty to which he is the constant victim. To him, your celebration is a sham. Your boasted liberty, an unholy license. Your national greatness, swelling vanity. Your sounds of rejoicing are empty and heartless. Your denunciations of tyrants, brass-fronted impudence. Your shouts of liberty and equality, hollow mockery. Your prayers and hymns, your sermons and thanksgivings, with all your religious parade and solemnity, are to him mere bombast, fraud, deception, impiety, and hypocrisy, a thin veil to cover up crimes which would disgrace a nation of savages. There is not a nation on the earth more guilty of practices so shocking and bloody as are the people of the United States at this very hour. Go where you may, search where you will, roam through all the monarchies and despotisms of the old world. Travel through South America. Search out every abuse. And when you've found the last, lay your facts by the side of the everyday practices of this nation. And you will say with me that for revolting barbarity and shameless hypocrisy, America reigns without rival.
Any of you know how many soldiers died in the Revolutionary War? I would guess that not too many people know, because it's never talked about. And because people assume it's an insignificant number, right? You know, there was the Battle of Bunker Hill, there was Valley Forge, there was the Battle of San... But, you know, it's no big deal. There's no point paying attention that we won the war, we got independence from England. 25,000 casualties. There may have been 50,000, but you probably know by now that casualty figures in war are very crude. Nobody really knows. There'll be disagreements up to 1 million. I'm serious. People, how many people died in Vietnam? Oh, I think 2 million. Or maybe 3 million. We're not sure. Really. Imagine not being sure. A million people just be, yeah, people don't know. 25,000, well, 25,000 is not much, right? 25,000, what's 25,000 lives if you win independence against England? 25,000 is less than half of the number of men who were soldiers who were killed in Vietnam. Well, wait a while. What was our population then? It was about 3 million. If you extrapolate, what would 25,000 dead mean in relation to the present population? Be 2.5 million. 2.5 million dead. So that if you want to say we are winning independence against England today, right? Let's pretend that today we've been subservient to England and we want to win independence, instead of, as is true, England is subservient to us and wants to win independence, you see. Would you be willing to sacrifice 2.5 million? Would you accept that 2.5 million people as a cost for gaining independence? Might you not say, well, hey, we do want independence, but is there another way? Another way we can do this without fighting a war that costs the lives of 2.5 million people? So there, on that side of the ledger, you have to put the human cost of war in every one of these good wars, and only then, and acknowledging the good side, but then at least you have an honest balance sheet, not a distorted balance, not a one-sided balance sheet, an honest balance sheet, and then you can make a judgment. If you decide, oh yeah, it would be worth 2.5 million to win independence from it, okay. You can make that judgment if you want, especially if none of those 2.5 million are related to you. But what about other factors? Another question is generally not asked about good wars. Good wars are generally based on a single criterion of something good that was won. And there are other things, peripheral issues, other issues, side issues, but they seem like side issues, that usually aren't examined. By that I mean is, okay, the colonists win independence from England. It's an interesting question. Who gains from victory in a war? Now, governments that fight wars, because it's governments that initiate wars and governments that fight wars, governments would like us to believe that all of us gain from a war. But that's not necessarily true. There are people who gain, and there are other people who don't gain. Did black slaves gain from the Revolutionary War? Slavery before the war, slavery after the war. Did the new government ushered in by the Constitution do away with slavery? No, it legitimized slavery. In fact, it declared slaves as 3/5 of a person, diminished the humanness of slaves. In fact, blacks did not rush. You would think if the Revolutionary War had anything to do with not just winning independence from England, but winning liberation for black people, they would have rushed to the colors, fought for their own. No, they didn't rush at all. Washington did not want blacks in the Revolutionary Army. The English recruited blacks into the Revolution, because to recruit them into it would have meant promising them freedom. No, this government, Washington, Madison, Jefferson, all slave owners, they were not going to promise freedom. The British were willing to, and they did. And only after the British began to enlist blacks, only then did the Continental Army begin to slowly enlist blacks. So in asking who gains from the war, well, I have to rule out black people as gaining from the Revolutionary War. What about, now here's a group that we don't even think about in relation to the Revolutionary War. Indians. Native Americans, they're here, they live here, they're on this continent, right? Our roads in Cape Cod are named after them, right? It's their land. We Europeans have come in and gradually encroached on their land, killing them if they get in the way. Did Indians gain from the Revolutionary War? Did their situation, what was their situation? It was a tremulous one because, you know, there are these colonists on the East Coast, and the colonists want to go westward into Indian territory, and So there's a lot of tension there. And so what do Indians gain from our independence from England? Not only do they gain nothing, it's worse for them. Because before the Revolutionary War, the British have set a line to the west of the colonies, roughly along the Appalachians. But they've set a line in 1763. It's called the Proclamation of 1763. And they've said, colonists cannot go beyond this line, because beyond this line, that's Indian territory. You know, it's not that the British were feeling kindly towards the Indians. They didn't want trouble, right? So it's, no, stay behind this line and don't go into Indian territory. What happens when we win the revolution? We wipe out that line. No more barrier. Now we can move westward, and we do. In fact, the next 100 years consists of our taking over the rest of the continent and in the process massacring our Indian tribes, driving them into a smaller and smaller part of the continent. No, Indians are not gaining from the Revolutionary War. These are people, aren't they? Just like white colonists who can celebrate independence. Black people are people. Indians are people. Shouldn't they be considered when you count up the cost and when you look at the balance sheet? Working people. Poor people. Were poor people the beneficiaries of the Revolutionary War? Did poor people rush to join Washington's army? No, they did not. There had to be conscription. And the rich could get out of conscription by paying a certain sum of money. This was a precedent which was set and which was then followed in the Civil War. Poor white people were not anxious to join the army. However, they were made promises. Oh, we'll give you some land. It's like, we'll give you a GI Bill of Rights. We'll give you some land. Your status will go up. Not only that, in the army, if you're in the army, you'll get paid and your life now is not that great. Well, you know, the usual situation. You join the military, and if your life up to this point has not been a very satisfying one, been a young guy and you don't know what your future brings, yeah, join the military. You'll get a uniform, you'll get a gun, you'll get some status. You might win some medals if you stay alive and come out of the war intact. You get a little land. So poor people did not simply flock to the revolutionary banner thinking that, oh, this is a war for us. They had very personal reasons, and many of them did not join. And when they did join the army, Washington's army, and they discovered that they were not being treated well, they discovered that the officers in the army, who came mostly from the upper classes, the officers in the army were getting fine clothes and shoes and good food, and they were getting salaries that were being paid. The GIs were not getting good clothes, not getting shoes, not getting good food, not getting paid. As a result, there were mutinies in the Revolutionary Army. Now, how many of you who have studied American history in school learned that there were mutinies in the Revolutionary Army? I would guess not many. I went all through, right, the education of a historian, right up to the PhD. How proud I am. All through the education of a historian. Did I ever learn that there were mutinies in the Revolutionary Army? Not at all. Not a word. But there were. Thousands of soldiers mutinied, thousands. It was serious. Washington had to deal with it. And there were too many to suppress, so he made concessions in order to appease them and stop the mutiny. That was the mutiny of the Pennsylvania Line, as it was called. Shortly after that, the concessions were made many of which were not followed through on, as usually happens when promises are made and they're not fulfilled. But shortly after the mutiny in the Pennsylvania line, there was a mutiny in the New Jersey line. A smaller mutiny, not thousands, hundreds. Washington said, well, we can deal with this. We don't have to make concessions here. We will execute the leaders of this mutiny. And Washington ordered the execution of the leaders of the mutiny. They were taken out and shot, and their fellow mutineers were given orders to shoot them. Don't learn about this. All of this is to say that the Revolutionary War, like all wars, was a class war. You're not supposed to say things like that. You're not supposed to bring up the issue of class when you're dealing with war. War, we're all in it together. We're all one class. We're all in one patriotic body. No. Wars affect different classes differently. Wars affect the rich and the poor differently. The benefits are not allocated equally to rich and poor from a war that's won. And in fact, when these working people, farmers, come back from the war to take up their little plots of land which are given to them, what do they find? They find that they're being treated like heroes and they're being thanked for the service they gave in the Revolutionary War? Hardly. Now they're going to be taxed on that land, taxed in such a way that they can't even pay those taxes. And then when they can't pay the taxes, their land, their farms, their livestock are going to be taken away from them. That's what leads to Shays' Rebellion. Right? That's something people learn about, right? Especially in Massachusetts, I think. At least they learn that it's something on a multiple choice test. Shays' Rebellion, oh yeah. Shays' Rebellion was serious. Shays' Rebellion with thousands of farmers in those towns in western Massachusetts surrounding the courthouses, not allowing the auctions to go on. An army had to be brought out to suppress them, an army financed by the rich merchants of Boston. It was crushed. But it was a sign, and for us looking back, a sign to us of, hey, what was this war fought for, and for whom was it fought, and who benefited from it, and who was betrayed by it? Working people were betrayed. And they'd seen their brothers and friends die in that war, and now they were being betrayed. The Shays' Rebellion takes place in 1786. Many of you know the date 1787, because that's the date of the Constitutional Convention. That's the date when the 55 men gather in Philadelphia, mostly rich white men, really, gather a representative group, you might say, as representative as our Congress and Senate are today. Yeah. 1987, they gather in Philadelphia and they draw up a constitution. Why do they draw up a constitution? Well, I know what I learned in school, and I'll bet they're still teaching at school. We had a weak central government. We needed a strong central government. So we had a constitution. We created a constitution to give us a strong central government. We can be proud, because we don't want our government to be strong. Well, it's true that a strong central government was set up. For what reason? Well, if you want to know the reason for the strong central government being set up, look at the correspondence that went back and forth among the founding fathers after Shays' Rebellion. Shays' Rebellion worried them. It was, by the way, it was not only taking place in Massachusetts, although we in Massachusetts, we learned about Shays' Rebellion. There were similar rebellions in other states of farmers. Founding fathers were worried about that. One of them, General Henry Knox of Massachusetts, I'm always proud of people from Massachusetts, especially if they're generals. And Henry Knox, one of Washington's colleagues in the army, after Shays' Rebellion, he wrote to Washington, and he said something like this. I can't, actually reproduce his elegant language. You know, these founding fathers, they spoke, wrote very elegantly. You compare, really, the whatever you can say about them, they knew how to use the English language. Compare them to our congressmen and senators today. really. But so Knox writes to George Washington after Shays' Rebellion, and he says, and I'll paraphrase in our own crude 21st century language, he says, you know, these people, there was these people, these people who fought in the Revolution, they think that because we won the war that they are entitled to an equal share of the wealth of this country. No. The Constitutional Convention is convened in the shadow of Shays' Rebellion and with the fear of future rebellions. A strong central government was set up not just because, oh, it's nice to have a strong central government. The strong central government was set up so you could have a government strong enough to suppress rebellion, to suppress working class rebellions, to suppress slave rebellions, to protect settlers and expansionists who move into Indian territory, a government that can raise an army. Yeah. So, you know, before you simply rush, say, wow, how good to have a strong central government. Strong for what? For what reason was that strength created? So I introduce these elements that we don't usually think about when we think about the Revolutionary War, rah-rah, Bunker Hill, just to make us think more complicated ways about so-called good wars and to ask who benefits from them and who doesn't benefit from them and what is the cost to human cost of the war. Yeah, let's take all of this into consideration and let's put that on the balance sheet. Yes, and let's acknowledge on the good side of the balance. Yeah, we win independence from England, okay. But let's have an honest look at that balance sheet and then ask, should we have fought a war for that, given what we know about the results of the war, the benefits of the war, the class character of the war, the casualties of the war? Well, of course, the question comes up, yeah, but don't you want us to have independence from England? No, that raises another question, a question that can be raised about all the good wars, and it will come up. If it doesn't come up, I'll bring it up. And that is, could we have put something good on the positive side of the balance sheet without that human cost? In other words, could we have won independence from England in a different way? We generally don't think of that. That is, when you have fought a war and you've won something, independence from England, the end of slavery, Hitler defeated, when you've fought a war and you've seen certain results, it embeds in you the idea that this was the only way it could have done. This very important thing to think about, and that is that if something has happened in history, if a certain scenario has unfolded in a certain way in history, we assume that that's the only way it could have unfolded. Because if we did assume that, we'd have to use our imagination and try to imagine something that didn't happen. If something happened, it has a reality, has a strength. If something didn't happen, if it's only a possibility, well, then we have to use our imagination. We have to use our imagination. Could independence from England have been won without that human cost and with different kind of results for different classes of people? Is that possible? It's worth thinking about. Didn't Canada get independence from England? Pretty much, right? Did they fight a bloody Revolutionary War? Granted, every situation is different and can't simply plaster one, but still, it's worth thinking about. Is it possible that the struggle against England could have gone on in different ways without Valley Forge and without Bunker Hill and without the Battle of Saratoga and without 2.5 million people dead? I insist on using that figure to bring us closer to reality. Is it possible that might have won independence some other way? have to use our imagination. That's hard. Have to imagine something that didn't happen, as opposed to accepting something that did happen. But I insist we have to do that. Otherwise, we're going to be stuck with history. Otherwise, we're going to be stuck with doing the same thing over and over again, because this is the only way it can be done. A year before, and here's just a little historical bit of evidence to just throw into the hopper. A year before Lexington and Concord, in other words, a year before the fighting began against England, farmers in western Massachusetts, all over the western Massachusetts, had driven out the British officials from the seats of government, the judges and the local officials, and had taken over much of western Massachusetts. And remember, at that time, you know, Boston, the city, was a very small percentage of the Massachusetts population. 90% of the people of Massachusetts lived out in the country. In those places in the country, the British were driven out without a war. They were driven out by huge numbers of people that gathered and made it impossible for them to continue. I mean, there's a book been written about that, a book which hadn't gotten a lot of attention, because very often books that tell the truth do not get a lot of attention. They tell you things you don't want to hear. A book by a man named Ray Raphael, who he wrote a book actually called The People's History of the American Revolution. People's History of the American Revolution, I recommend it, naturally. But he also wrote another book called The First American Revolution, and it's about those events that take place before Lexington and Concord, in which people nonviolently, that is without a war, take over. And so you wonder, at least makes you wonder, could have been possible without a war for the colonists to resist England, to build up an underground, to wage a kind of guerrilla warfare, to make it impossible for the British to govern without a war? And after all, when a place becomes impossible to govern, even imperial powers retreat from them. They can't control the situation, and so they leave. It's worth thinking about. So much for that holy war. The Civil War. Well, on the plus side, right, the balance sheet, slavery. I mean, you can't deny that. The Civil War is fought and slavery is ended. But even while not forgetting that, I mean, that is very, very important. Well, not forgetting that, it's worthwhile at least looking at the other side of the balance sheet. 600,000 dead in the Civil War. I mean, how many people knew those figures? Most people haven't even thought about it. They know it's a bloody war, okay, but people haven't thought 600,000. In a population of 30 million, 600,000 today would mean we fought a civil war in which 5 million people died. What if we wanted to end racial segregation? Well, or maybe even slavery. Should we fight a war in which 5 million people die in order to end slavery? Now, of course, we want slavery to end. But is this the only way it could have been done, with a war that takes 600,000 lives? There are countries in other parts of the world and in the Western Hemisphere that did away with slavery and without a bloody war. All over Latin America and the West Indies. It's worth thinking about. It's not that we want to retain slavery. No, we do want to end slavery. But again, have to let our imaginations go. Is it possible slavery might have been ended some other way? Maybe it would have taken longer. This is a very important factor. If you want to avoid horrendous violence and accomplish something, you may have to wait longer. The nice thing about violence, it's fast. You want to accomplish something fast, violence will do it. But very often you can accomplish the same thing without violence if you have a more orchestrated plan of not submission, not appeasement, not giving in, not allowing the status quo to go on, but gradually eroding the status quo. Think of South Africa. The African National Congress, which was, you know, represented the black population of South Africa, the African National Congress could have, they're facing apartheid, which is a kind of slavery, certainly, not far from slavery, apartheid. The majority of the population in South Africa, they could afford a bloody, they could have gotten arms from the outside. They had friends and sympathizers, and they could have instigated an armed rebellion to overthrow the apartheid regime. And they would have won, probably won. How long would it take? Maybe a couple of years. Who knows? 2, 3, 4, we don't know exactly. How many people would die in the course of that struggle? Oh, we don't know, 1 million, 2 million, most of them black, right? But at the end of it, apartheid would be over. And people would say, that's the only way it could have been done. Just as they say about the Revolutionary War, that's the only way we could have won independence. About the Civil War, that's the only way we could have ended slavery. By the way, just a footnote about ending slavery after the Civil War. We did not really end slavery. It's not simply, oh, they were slaves and now they're free. No, they weren't free. They were put back into serfdom, not slavery, but serfdom after the Civil War. They were left without resources. And they had to go back and work now for the same plantation owners that they were enslaved by, now but with the same kinds of restrictions on them because they had no resources. So this, to say slavery was ended, not quite true. And as you know, the black people then went through 100 years after the supposed end of slavery and after the 13th, 14th, and 15th amendments were passed to the Constitution promising racial equality, so on. For 100 years after the supposed end of slavery, black people are segregated and live as second-class human beings. So while on a positive side you say, oh, we ended slavery, well, you have to put quotation marks around end of slavery. Not quite. So I'm suggesting that we have to at least begin to question these so-called good wars, because we want, I think, to reach a situation in the world where war is not acceptable, no matter what reason is given you. Not acceptable. War in our time is always a war against innocent people, especially children. But no matter what the objective, however noble the objective, or get rid of this tyrant or stop this aggression, whatever the good reason is on the good side of the ledger, on the bad side of the ledger will be huge numbers of innocent people will die, and a large number of them children. And the world will be poisoned once again with the germ of war, and we'll continue our addiction to war. That's another thing to think about. War is addictive, and the more shots you take of it, the more addicted you become. And we have to break our habit. Thank you.
Governments are instituted among us. is America to me? A name, a map of a flag I see, a certain word, a democracy. What is America to me? The house I live in, the friends that I have found, the folks beyond the railroad, and the people all around, the worker and the farmer, the sailor on the sea, the men who built this country, that's America to me. The words of old Abe Lincoln, of Jefferson and Payne, of Washington and Jackson, and the tasks that still remain, the little bridge at Concord, where freedom's fight began, on Gettysburg and Midway, and the story of the tan. The house I live in, my neighbors white and black, the people who just came here, or from generations back, the town hall and the soapbox, the torch of liberty, a home for all God's children, that's America to me. The house I live in, the goodness everywhere, a land of wealth and beauty, with enough for all to share, a house that we call freedom, the home of liberty, but especially the people, that's America to me. But especially the people, that's the truth, America.
Many's the time I've been mistaken, and many times confused. Yes, and I've often felt forsaken, and certainly misused. Oh, but I'm all right, I'm all right, just weary to my bones. Still, you don't expect to be bright and bon vivant so far away from home. So far away from home. I don't know a soul who's not been battered. I don't have a friend who feels at ease. I don't know a dream that's not been shattered or driven to its knees. Oh, but it's all right, it's all right, for we lived so well so long. Still, when I think of the road we're traveling on, I wonder what's gone wrong. I can't help it, I wonder what's gone wrong. And I dreamed I was dying. I dreamed that my soul rose unexpectedly, and looking back down at me, smiled reassuringly. And I dreamed I was flying, and high up above, my eyes could clearly see. liberty sailing away to sea, and I dreamed I was flying. Well, we come on the ship they call the Mayflower. We come on the ship that sails the moon. We come in the ages most uncertain hours and sing an American tune. Oh, and it's all right. It's all right, it's all right. You can be forever blessed. Still, tomorrow's gonna be another working day. Trying to get some rest. That's all I'm trying to get some rest.
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. This morning, a long-postponed and long-awaited interview with Tom Doyle, including a wonderful reading, and Dan Persons has an interview of the movie Byzantium. Stay tuned. Thank you.
Hey, I'm Dan Persons, writer and critic for CineFantastic Online over at cfqonline.com. Director Neil Jordan is pretty much an unabashed romantic, to the point where the films that he makes that aren't fantasy still in some ways feel like they are, to the point where even the films that seem to be fantasy may turn out actually not to be. I won't cite specific titles here because the discovery is part of the kick. But it's that romanticism that's both the blessing and the curse of Byzantium, definitely a fantasy film, horror more specifically, and something of an unofficial sequel to Jordan's Interview with the Vampire. In present day, a 200-year-old mother and daughter team of vampires are on the run. They take refuge in a seaside town where the mother, played by Gemma Arterton, sets up a brothel in a sleazy hotel called the Byzantium, and the daughter, played by Saoirse Ronan, and tiring of her life of secrecy and desperation, strikes up a romantic relationship with a teenage boy dying of leukemia, who's played by Caleb Landry Jones. That relationship may be their undoing, as Ronan seeks to come out of the shadows, and a couple of mysterious pursuers continue their hunt. Jordan knows how to handle this stuff. As with his previous films, he can imbue settings, be they seedy or luxurious, with their own brand of sensuousness, and he creates a credible mother-daughter dynamic, both fractious and loving, between Arterton and Ronan. And he creates an interesting mythology here for his vampires, complete with an impressive conversion sequence in a mysterious shrine, and a secret brotherhood that oversees the process and doesn't take kindly to women availing themselves of those powers, whether for good or ill. But Jordan maybe wants too much of this film, and there is the sense that he's jamming too many pegs into a single hole. He wants this to be a mother-daughter bonding tale, and a Twilight Saga-style teen romance, and a tale of liberation with women struggling against a calcified patriarchy. There isn't any reason it can't be all these things, but as done here, the pieces don't hum together, and there's too much the sense of things happening because that's what's supposed to be happening, as opposed to rising naturally from the story. That's particularly true towards the end, when Jordan wishes to orchestrate a change in the way we regard one of the main characters, without doing anything to set us up for the change beyond having another character tell us why we should feel that way. As good a filmmaker as Jordan can be, and as admirable as his motivations may be, his powers fail him here, and the film exits on a sense of a promise unfulfilled. But while it lasts, there is promise to Byzantium, and it's worth seeing for its performances, its atmosphere, and its unique take on Gothic romanticism. I'm Dan Persons. Stay up to date on what's going on in the world of fantastic film and TV over at cfqonline.com.
And not to mention the fact that Dan recorded that for here. I am going to take a slight dissent. As people know, make a point of almost not going to vampire movies or anything like that, but I did on Sunday. I went with my partner and with Margot Adler. And, you know, if you're going to go see a vampire film, Margot is the right person to do it. And by the way, don't forget her new book about the current vampire craze is out on, just go to margotadler.com, margotadler.com, and it's called Out for Blood, and as Margot puts it, it's cheaper than an ice cream cone. It's an Amazon single. It's really, you know, an essay, and a rather good one. At any rate, I thought the movie gelled perfectly. I thought that all of these individual parts and like that worked as a whole very, very nicely. And, you know, this from somebody who doesn't like this kind of cinema in general. I thought it was clever. I thought the reveals were very good. I think the review that we just heard, in fact, gives, and a lot of the reviews I've read, just saying that it's mother-daughter, they don't tell you until, like, you know, 35 minutes into the film, it's mother-daughter. This is not on the level of Neil Jordan. You know, she's a guy, but it's, you know, the less said about it, the better. Other than, as vampire stories go, this is an unusual one and heartily recommended, even if, like me, you are allergic to gore. This is WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifico Radio at 99.5 FM. For a long time, I have been trying to get Tom Doyle on the air. Tom is a wonderful writer. I see him usually at Washington, D.C., science fiction conventions, and at a few others. And he has a new book out, plus some other stuff in the works that we will hear about. And every single time, it's three times in total that we have scheduled him to be on the show, instead, you know, either a preemption or a fundraising drive took place. So we said the hell with it, and we recorded this at my house. Therefore, you will hear lawnmowers, you will hear airplanes, and unfortunately during the reading, you will occasionally hear my hand moving as I move the mic. This is something I'm going to have to correct in the future, and I'm actually building sort of like a mini studio at my place to deal with this in the future. Nevertheless, the content is excellent and very good. And by the way, it runs almost, well, right up until the end of the program at 3 a.m. So with no further ado, we take you back in the Wayback Machine to May 15th of this year. And by the way, happy 4th of July. And now, by the magic of recording, I introduce you to Tom Doyle. We will start by slating this, as it were, by saying today is May 15th, indeed. I believe, the Ides of May.
Yes, beware.
Indeed. Well, May, not March, and mid-afternoon.
Okay.
The Brooklyn, my personal Brooklyn studios. So with me is Tom Doyle.
Hi, Tim. Good to see you.
Likewise. And this is our third attempt at getting Tom live on the air, and it just didn't happen, usually because every single time we tried to do it, how do you know when WBAI is going to go into a fun drive? You can tell because that means I've got Tom scheduled to do a show.
I'm a Jonah. I'm clearly cursed, but we're getting it done, so I couldn't be happier.
Oh, there's a thought. The Jonah of the airwaves.
Yes. or the flying Doyle or something like that that just can never put into land and get the interview done.
Yes,
it has to always be at sea. Cue Wagner in the background.
Yes, exactly. So who am us anyway? I don't think I've mentioned I'm Jim Freund. I have mentioned that you're Tom Doyle. Who be Tom Doyle?
Tom Doyle writes science fiction and fantasy in Washington, D.C., and lately I've put a collection together of my short stories that Lawrence Schoen has published through his Paper Golem Press.
Right.
And Tom Doyle's had a great year.
He was going to send me a copy, and he never did.
But I've brought one for you.
Well, thank you.
No.
I have to get after Lawrence.
Oh, he's been a busy. You know, he's a busy guy. He's got a lot of fingers in a lot of creative
places.
Pies,
and
I'm just very happy. I mean, he's done this twice before for other collections for newer authors, and he's been pretty lucky so